Welcome to the Asia edition of Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech podcast. I'm Rachel Williamson.
And I'm Karis Palmer. Every fortnight, we dissect the successes and failures of financial innovators and bring you the people at the top of their field working to disrupt banking.
From traditional banks doing things differently to startups navigating the unforgiving world of financial services, I'm Simon Spencer, and this is Breaking Banks Asia.
Dough.
Moolah.
Bezos.
Cream. Merrill.
Folding stuff.
Whatever you call it, it's getting harder to find.
But for wallets like Momo or GCash, I would say cash is still the biggest competitor. And while these businesses have displaced cash over the last few years to a larger extent, I think it's still the tip of the iceberg.
Welcome to Breaking Banks Asia. I'm your host, Karis Palmer, and in this two-part series, we ask, when will cash die out, and what are its most successful competitors? From cards and digital wallets to super apps and digital currency, we ask the experts, like Momo Chair Anthony Thomas, who opened the show, what will be the killer app to kill cash in Asia, and what would mass uptake of global digital payments mean for financial inclusion in our region? We'll start in Australia, where cash versus its alternatives has become a political issue, and then move out to Asia's most digitally savvy markets, where even with huge uptake of digital payments, cash lives on and millions of people live unbanked.
It's now easier than it has been in the past to conceive of a world in which banknotes are used for relatively few payments, that cash becomes a relatively niche payment instrument.
This is former Australian Reserve Bank Governor Philip Lowe speaking 5 years ago in 2018.
I'd like to structure my remarks this morning around three broad themes. The first is that the shift to electronic payments is occurring quite quickly, and that's likely to continue. And this shift is likely to be a positive development for our collective welfare. The second point is that if we are to realise the benefits of moving to a near cashless payment system, the electronic system needs to offer the functionality, the safety, and the reliability that people require. People need to have confidence that the electronic system will be operating when they need to make their payments and that will deliver the payment services they need. The third point is that as we undertake this journey towards a near cashless payment system, there will be greater focus on the cost of electronic payments. If almost all our payments are electronic, then the cost of making those payments matters more than it used to. The electronic system needs to be as efficient as it can be and to be characterised by strong competition. And in my view, there's further work to be done here.
Fast forward to September last year, and Matt Comyn, the CEO of Australia's largest bank, CommBank, threw down the gauntlet on cash, telling a Senate committee hearing that distributing cash costs the bank $400 million a year, or as he spelled out, $40 for every one of its 10 million customers. He went a step further, arguing that many bank customers who don't use cash were cross-subsidising those who do. A comment which got up the nose of people like Jason Bryce, a business and finance journalist who also runs a pro-cash lobby group called Cash Welcome.
I bought a bottle of water the other day, okay? It was really nice. It was a fancy brand. It had little bubbles and it was great. But I'm not voting for them to take away the tap on my kitchen sink, you know? The water that comes to my house and to every other residence in Australia is national economic infrastructure. If I choose to go and buy a bottle of water, that doesn't mean I'm giving up on the right to access water from the tap. And the cash distribution system is not something that can be turned off and turned on again when you need it. It's got to be there all the time.
Jason says cash hoarding during the COVID-19 pandemic was a big vote of confidence in the cash system, and he's watching closely for countries which are beginning to mandate cash as a payment option.
We've got to start the conversation. You know, are we going to be pushed into this against our will? Some nations are ahead of us, for example, Sweden. And last year, Sweden had to backtrack and mandate that banks must reopen ATMs in towns where they'd closed them to ensure that every single citizen in Sweden has access to cash within a certain number of kilometres of their front door. So, you know, everybody in Sweden uses the Swish app, and great, I would probably too if I lived there, but some people are being discriminated against, excluded and left out, and that agenda, Sweden has found, has gone too far, too quickly. People have been left out, and it's been put back on the banks to ensure that everybody has access to an ATM machine or some means of withdrawing cash within a reasonable number of kilometres of their home.
But what do you do when cash use declines so much the business model behind ATMs falls apart? That's the situation Australia has found itself in, with cash payments declining from 70% in 2007 to just 13% in 2022. Australia's central bank governor, Michelle Bullock, gave a landmark speech on payments in December last year.
The challenging economics of cash distribution was one of the main factors behind the recent merger of the two largest cash-in-transit providers, Linfox Armaguard and Prosegur, which the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission approved earlier this year. The merger was approved subject to a three-year undertaking from the firms regarding pricing and service levels. As part of this, Linfox Armaguard gave an undertaking to continue supplying CIT services to existing customers until 2026. Now, the merger was intended to address the structural decline and overcapacity in the CIT industry, and reduce the risk of one or both of the CIT companies suddenly exiting the industry, which would cause a lot of disruption in the availability of cash in the economy. Now, despite the merger having taken place as proposed, Linfox Armaguard is now indicating that its CIT business continues to be unsustainable. Given these issues, the RBA recently convened a roundtable discussion with industry participants to discuss what more could be done to promote the sustainability of the cash distribution system. These discussions are ongoing, and industry, regulators and government will need to continue to work together to put in place sustainable arrangements for cash distribution. I'd have to say that many other countries are facing similar challenges associated with declining transactional use of cash.
Unlike her predecessor, Michelle Bullock seems less than sold on the idea that the shift to electronic payments will be a positive development for our collective welfare.
Cash does remain an important method of payment for some people, and it's widely held as a precautionary or store of wealth. Cash is also an important backup method during system outages or natural disasters when electronic payments might be unavailable. I had no sympathy for my son when his card didn't work and he had no cash on him at the petrol station, for example. For these reasons, the RBA places a high priority on the community continuing to have reasonable access to cash withdrawal and deposit services. Businesses and consumers are more reliant on electronic payment systems than ever before, with outages becoming increasingly disruptive to everyday life. We're therefore going to step up our oversight of these systems, particularly the new payments platform and the card schemes.
In fact, Australia's central bank is in the middle of an overhaul of retail payments regulation that will see buy now, pay later providers, payment gateways, payment facilitators and mobile wallet providers like Apple Pay all fall under its regulatory purview. Because remember that comment by Commonwealth Bank CEO Matt Comyn on the cost of cash? At the same time as the bank's been bemoaning the challenge of being a cash distributor, its lobbyists have also been pushing hard to see payments competitors like Apple Pay fall subject to the same regulation it faces. And that wish will soon come true with new payments legislation about to hit Australia's Parliament. Dr. Brad Pragnell is a payments policy expert who served as head of policy at the Australian Payments Clearing Association and has also spent a lot of time in Canada consulting with Payments Canada on its payment strategy roadmap. He recently returned from Rwanda, which is emerging as a new hub of innovation in digital payments. We asked him about Australia's new strategic plan for payments and how it stacks up against that of our regional neighbours.
I think that the Treasury in Australia has made a very good effort in terms of the strategic plan of trying to craft a way forward. I mean, I think they have created a big agenda, and the need to deliver that is going to be very, very challenging, I think, for everyone involved. I do think that the licensing reforms that are part of this are very critical. And I do think that you know, Treasury in Australia and the industry really need to take the time to make sure that they measure twice and cut once. I think if our regulators think, or policymakers think about payments as being both, you know, a store of value, and thinking about what is that value, how is that value stored, how is that value transmitted, but also viewing it in terms of the data, you know, how is the data created, how is the data stored, how is the data transmitted, how is the data validated. You start to look at it in that sense, and then you can start to say, okay, well, you know, who's doing what, you know, in that chain. And you want to make sure that if someone is doing a similar activity, that you're treating them in a similar sense. I mean, we don't want to crowd out innovation, but we also don't want to have innovation driven by regulatory arbitrage, where people are able to take advantage of loopholes or sort of clever interpretations of the law to drive innovation. You know, we want innovation to be driven in terms of, you know, how good is your value prop, you know, your pricing, your UX, your technology, all that sort of stuff, not how clever are you able to kind of, you know, work your way around the regulation. So I think finding that more level playing field, that more consistent way of doing it is going to be very important. I mean, Australia is playing a bit of catch up compared to some other regulators and some other jurisdictions in terms of thinking about this, but you know, we're on the road now, and hopefully Australia will find its path.
So while Australia gets busy with regulating the likes of Apple Pay and Afterpay to bring them in line with the major banks, payments innovation is happening at a rapid rate elsewhere. Here's Brad Pragnell again.
I do look at what is happening, for instance, in Singapore, and I think regulators, policymakers in other jurisdictions really do see their role very differently. I mean, you look at what the Monetary Authority of Singapore is doing, it really sees its role as being catalytic. It is, and it's operating with a great degree of urgency. And I'm starting to see that approach manifest itself in other parts of the developing world. I mean, I just came back from Rwanda, and they're trying to turn themselves into effectively the Singapore of East Africa. So, you know, in developing markets, they understand that regulators have that catalytic role. You come back to developed markets in Australia or Canada, you know, even the United States, and regulators are very responsive and reactive. It's about stopping bad things from happening rather than making sure that good things happen. You know, in jurisdictions like Australia, I think we do need to look at, well, what are they doing well in places like Singapore? How have they been able to kind of work through catalyzing the market, making sure good things happen and not just, you know, worrying about stopping bad things. So the regulator, you know, will take on that very, you know, facilitative approach. I mean, obviously sandboxes are very important as well too, in terms of allowing fintechs to experiment and try different things, pushing hard on access. You know, some of these jurisdictions are really looking at making sure that non-banks have access to payment systems. And I think that's something that we should be working at quite a bit more. And then I think also a lot of the soft stuff. I mean, you look at what the Monetary Authority of Singapore is doing in terms of, you know, the FinTech Festival, in terms of a lot of the other initiative it's trying to do, trying to create that community. You know, I think that sort of stuff is actually really important. And I think governments and central banks, regulators can play an important role. Clearly, the private sector needs to play an important role too, but to just leave it completely to the private sector, I think is missing, you know, an important ingredient there.
The other place where regulators can and are playing a role is encouraging or even mandating the seamless movement of money across borders. And in most markets in our region, encouraging financial inclusion, which can be a tricky path to tread. To get a handle on what's happening with cash cards and wallets across Asia, we spoke with Anthony Thomas, who spent 25 years at Citi across 7 markets before transitioning to FinTech, where he served as CEO of GCash in the Philippines and is now MD of FinTech at Delivery Hero and Executive Chairman of Momo in Vietnam. It was Anthony's voice you heard at the start of the show.
Spare a thought for the regulators. They have a tough job balancing between allowing innovation to scale and solving problems, whether it be inclusion or convenience and balancing that with systemic risks, with consumer protection, with countering anti-money laundering and, you know, money laundering and criminal activity. Incentives are also skewed, where they don't get a lot of kudos for an innovative financial system, as they do get consequences, and quite often personal consequences, when things go wrong. Right. So regulators and in fact, governments, since they tend not to be entirely independent, have specific objectives. And all players, big or small, tech or non-tech, need to align with these objectives to be successful. Right. And one can't deny an overlay of, say, geopolitics creeping in, particularly because payment transactions are a source of national intelligence, if you will.
So not many people admit that payments transactions are intelligence. Given there are leaders and laggards on the policy front, what countries do you think are doing digital payments well?
It's useful to look at country by country, and I know we can't go through every country in Asia, but let me try and look at 8 countries with a population of around 100 million or more that account for 80% plus of the population in Asia. And you look at India, and the biggest digital payment story in the last few years has, of course, been UPI. And you see that some of the biggest beneficiaries there are Google Pay, which is, you know, as big tech as it gets, and PhonePe, which is an offshoot of Flipkart and Walmart ultimately, right? So I think that in India, the government pushed UPI at zero cost, so social welfare payments could go directly to beneficiaries, right? And I think it paid for itself in cutting out the multiple layers in between. Now, anyone who enabled this to scale, whether big tech or a commerce player or a local wallet or a bank, benefited. Right? So incumbents suffered because traditional business models were not viable. But that's India. I think China, of course, went down the path of digital payments probably 10 plus years prior to India, with the two big tech players, right? Or emerged big tech players, and Alipay and WeChat Pay kind of dominated. Of course, more recently, they've tried to correct for this dominance. But I think they also understand that these two companies became giants as they were solving real problems. And now they're trying to balance this out. In Southeast Asia, which is closer to a context that I'm even more familiar with, I think local wallets in the three most populous, let's say, Indonesia, Philippines, Vietnam. If you look at, say, OVO in Indonesia or GCash in the Philippines or Momo in Vietnam, they solved the problem of inclusion and brought convenience at low cost, right? So regulators tended to actually enable this. Now, of course, there are nuances. In Vietnam, for example, unlike in Indonesia and Philippines, the regulator doesn't allow you to have a wallet that is not linked to a bank account, right? But we all work within that, and there are pros and cons. Of course, we skipped, let's say, Pakistan and Bangladesh, which are relatively less developed on digital payments. But wallets, again, like Easy Pesa or Jazz Cash in Pakistan, again, both telco linked, or Bcash in Bangladesh have scaled. Again, in some of these underdeveloped markets, it was actually Alipay who invested in several markets to create these valuable businesses, all within different regulatory regimes. Of course, we skipped, I think, only Japan, which is one of the most developed and heavily banked, but still, surprisingly, has a lot of cash transactions. Of course, that, I think, has to do with the perception of safety and is deeply cultural. Though more recently, I think even their wallets like PayPay and LinePay, et cetera, are increasing in popularity. So I think that it's the context, and I go through all of this only to demonstrate it, that it's the context, and as long as it's aligned with certain country objectives, it's not difficult to work with the regulator to solve problems which are their problems as much as each of the players.
That's really, really valuable to go through them like that. But I love that you brought in geopolitics in the early part of that discussion, because at its pure heart,
probably the first time in history where, with the talk of, you know, CBDCs and real digital currencies, where regulators are actually being drawn into the game, right? Where they're actually to say, what role do we want to play and who do we want to align with in this game? And at the same time, that tension with the private market, right? So it is all politics, because it's like, if you're the regulator, you have to make a decision for financial inclusion. To what extent do I operate, and to what extent do I let the private market take that business? Where do you think it will come down? You know, if you had to make a long-term geopolitical guess on where it might end up.
The reason I also went through each market is you will see a trend. There is almost no player that is successful in more than one market at scale. Right? Mm. Even if you look at Ant, when they invested in these businesses, they always took minority stakes. And that's probably astute of them. And it probably was keeping this in mind, right? Because ultimately, local, even in the banking system, forget wallets or payment companies, even in the banking system, if you look at it, it's local banks that ultimately are solving better, because there tends to be greater alignment with the local regulator, and there tends to be an industry structure that works. And anyone who's trying to be successful in more than one market, particularly if it's not their home market, has a much tougher job. Now, the whole thing around cross-border payments comes in, and that's where there are efforts to at least be interoperable, because you know, payments is not restricted to, you know, within your borders. Though I would still say that that's the large majority that the regulator needs to solve for. I think having efficient cross-border payments and solving those problems is also important. And that's why you'll see particular countries being more interested, where flows are a little more relevant for them. I think there are two contexts, right? One is payments or transactions, right? And I think there, again, local banks and private entities will continue to thrive. I think that even, you know, that there is this whole question of CBDCs, I think you referred to it, whether that would replace, I'm not sure. It's an interesting development. I think it's more to curb the other context, which is of cryptocurrency, right? Which is a store of value as opposed to the payment context. And that's where I think governments and regulators are a little more concerned and saying, look, if this is something that's going to be developed, and if blockchain technology is really an answer, then we want to make sure that we are front and center of that, because central banks ultimately have a role, and the job of having to manage criminal activity, money laundering, etc., terrorism financing, becomes important, and that's where I think there is a greater sort of fear of disintermediation at a central bank or a government level, where each country is making their own move towards protecting that. But payment transactions ultimately depend on the banking system. I think that bank accounts are still the largest funding source for many wallets. Mm-hmm. So wallets rely on banks. Wallet apps are relevant in a certain context because they're designed for a wide variety of use cases with a convenient user experience, and typically for small ticket, high frequency needs. Mm-hmm. And banks are relevant in potentially larger transactions, which are probably the most important for rent or making a purchase, etc. I think all of this will continue to be preserved, and I think works well for private entities to solve, and it works well for the regulator that private entities are solving it.
So
So does that mean we'll never see widespread bank disruption and the removal of cash? To dig a little deeper on this, we spoke with Monica Jasuja, who is currently based in India and has more than 20 years' experience building innovative digital products in the financial services industry.
Hey, I'm Monica Jasuja. I'm an ambassador for Emerging Payments Association Asia. I'm on the advisory board of Merchant Risk Council, as well as a global think tank, only in fintech.
So, yeah, you've worked both at MasterCard and PayPal in Asia and the US, and so seen both sides of it. Was cash seen as their biggest competitor in that time you were there and I guess now?
I would have to admit that cash is a competitor for almost every digitization effort that happens. But instead of looking at just cash as a competitor, the whole idea was how do we drive people towards more cashless methods in order to, for them to be able to have better lives and to drive their businesses. So if you look and flip this question more from the business's point of view, suddenly it becomes not a fight against cash, but it becomes a fight for a better life. The reason I say this is because when I was thinking about the question, one thing that strikes at me is that cash is never the issue. The problem is how many people are using cash because they're not able to use digital payments. And that typically tells us a little bit about the society and the people who we are targeting in general from a financial services point of view, which happens to be people who have access. So access typically means that you have the money. And lack of access typically means that you do not have money, which makes it difficult to pay with digital payments. So, for example, in COVID and post-COVID, we saw this huge increase in cash being used again. And the reason was that people were losing jobs and therefore they actually depended on check-to-paycheck existence. And they were also using a lot of BNPL. Now, that itself indicates that access is almost directly proportional to enablement, which is also directly proportional to the spending capabilities. And in Asia, there is a very interesting phenomenon, which I don't see in the US, which is that the governments are playing this very important role to be able to push financial inclusion. But rather than calling it financial inclusion, I think they look at this as access to goods and services and enablement of that access so that they have better lives and they are pulled out of poverty. So, for example, India pulled out 130 million out of poverty in the last couple of years, which is fairly significant. I think that's why for MasterCard and PayPal, the focus and the fight was always to be able to have a more connected world where businesses were able to accept all kinds of payments now. They went from cards to, you know, mobile wallet to now all kinds of payments, including account-to-account payments, so that they have better lives and they're able to get more, so merchants are able to get more consumers at the retail and the e-commerce stores, have better businesses, and consumers have more choices to pay. So I look at this more from the angle of merchants rather than just consumers.
Payment services that can improve people's lives. That's an ambition we can all get behind. In part two of Cash, Cards and Wallets, we'll look at what India's controversial demonetization program has meant for cash and its competitors, and also hear from an economist on what might work to remove cash. Plus, we'll dig into the systems and rules that need to be put in place in a world where cash is no more.
If you enjoyed today's episode of Breaking Banks Asia, don't forget to share it on Twitter, leave us a 5-star review on iTunes or wherever you listen to our show. This helps us build our audience and support our sponsors so we can continue to bring you a great show every fortnight.